Case number 24-7013. Istok Plevnik, appellant versus Eugene R. Sullivan et al. Mr. Fine for the appellant, Mr. Cady for the appellee Eugene Sullivan, Mr. Genda for the appellee United States.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning. Thank you.
Fine. Please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Your honors, I'd like to at least correct, I think, two misunderstandings at the lower court with regard to the complaint. One, I think there was a misimpression that my client, Istok Plevnik, had signed a written engagement letter with a defendant, Mr. Sullivan, for $50,000. It's referenced in paragraph 14 of our complaint, and I think in the joint appendix, page 35, where I think the judge erroneously believed that engagement letter was with the defendant when it was not. There was never anything in writing between the appellant here, Istok Plevnik, and Mr. Sullivan. There was never an agreement as to whether he would get paid anything, but I just wanted to clear up that one point. The second one, there seems to be some belief below by the district court that the funds that were involved here in Africa belonged, were owned by the United States. There isn't anything in the record in the complaint that supports that speculation. It's odd that the United States, if it believed it owned the funds, wouldn't have sent their ambassador to go retrieve them, or the embassy, which was alerted by Mr. Plevnik as to where the funds could be found in Ivory Coast. But those are two points I thought were important for the court to know about. With regard to Mr. Sullivan's, our claim of common law fraud against Mr. Sullivan, the district court decided that we had not adequately pled common law fraud because Mr. Sullivan had agreed to be Mr. Plevnik's lawyer, even though it was oral, he could serve pro bono. But I think it's standard law that if a person enters into a contract at the outset, not intending to perform, that's a misrepresentation of state of mind, which can be a predicate of a common law fraud claim. And that's what we alleged in this case. I think it's replete of all the allegations which recite the betrayals of Mr. Sullivan, of Mr. Plevnik in retrieving the billions of dollars in the Ivory Coast.
How do you get around Chaharis and Ludwig?
I couldn't hear you, Your Honor.
How do you get around the Chaharis case and the Ludwig and Robinson case?
Well, we think that those are cases where a violation of the contractor intent came after the formation. It wasn't misrepresentation of state of mind. And Your Honor, we cite cases in our reply brief which show clearly this court's conclusion that if at the time you make the contract, you do not intend to perform, here, not intend to discharge duties of loyalty and honesty, that can be the foundation for a common law fraud claim. Of course, we have to prove it at trial. It's not something that can just be accepted as a presumption. I think in this case, the judge assumed that we had not alleged that that misrepresentation had occurred at the outset, but there's a fleeting reference, well, later on, in down the contract road, when Mr. Sullivan had performed some legal services for Mr. Plevnik, although we argue they were undertaken to induce Mr. Plevnik to reveal the whereabouts of the funds that Mr. Sullivan could loot.
The amended complaint refers to a payment of $50,000.
That was to Rudy Giuliani, Your Honor, not to Mr. Sullivan. I think if you look at paragraph 14, of the complaint is $50,000 to Rudy Giuliani. That agreement remained dormant and never actually became operative. So we believe that the argument that's made that because there were some legal services performed, that automatically it disproved common law fraud. But let me suggest the following analogy, which is imperfect, but I think informative. Suppose you have a doctor. He's a heart surgeon, and he's paid by an enemy of a patient. Hey, I want you to amputate this patient's legs.
You said he's paid by whom? What's the example?
Excuse me?
You said he's paid by whom? I just want to make sure I'm understanding the example.
The doctor is paid by an enemy of the patient, mm-hmm, okay, to represent that he's going to perform open heart surgery, but he really is going to amputate the legs of the patient because he wants to get back to the patient. And so the doctor undertakes preliminary services, takes the vital signs of the patient, advises on fluid and food intake. But then when the anesthesia is issued, instead of doing the heart surgery, he amputates the legs. I think that's a clear case of common law fraud, even though it's true that the doctor did perform some medical services, taking the vital signs, suggesting what fluid and food intake would be appropriate for this kind of surgery.
The problem is that the Ludwig case holds that you've got to show that the duties that are part and parcel of the fraud are divisible or different than the duties that were already within the scope of the contract.
Well, you're wrong.
You don't have that in your example, and I'm not sure how you have that in the facts alleged in your complaint.
Well, Your Honor, I would refer you, Your Honor, to this is page in our reply brief. This is page 4. These are citing cases of the D.C. Court of Appeals, which is the one that establishes the common law fraud elements, because this is a D.C. cause of action. And you'll see on page 4 there, it is black letter law, a party who signs a contract intending non-performance has perpetrated common law fraud. And then there's a citation there. The question arises whether the breach of a contractual promise can ever be the subject of the tort of fraudulent misrepresentation. We have held that it can. I'm quoting from that decision, Your Honor. A promise or contractual commitment may be actionable fraud as misrepresentation if at the time of its making the promisor had no present intention of carrying it out.
So let me ask where your strongest allegation is then, which I assume you will argue the district court should construe most favorably to your client, because the amended complaint refers to various actions that appeared to be consistent with representation of your client's wish to repatriate these funds?
Yes, Your Honor. It's a wonderful question. I think the answer is that, as we have alleged, those services were done to induce confidence in my client that enabled him to reveal the whereabouts of the funds that resulted in the perpetration of the fraud. Without having that trust or confidence, my client, we allege, would never have revealed this information. So, Your Honor, that's the response to your question.
I don't understand then. Your client claimed that he had knowledge of funds coming from Libya that were in Africa, and he wanted to bring them to the United States, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I think they were in Ivory Coast, but they may have originated in Libya.
And the allegation about putting $6 million in a local police station. The issue that the district court mentioned was the fact that the Department of Justice has responsibilities for recapturing funds abroad. And what is the allegation as to these funds? That your client wanted to bring them back to the United States as his personal property?
Your Honor, are you finished, Your Honor? I don't want to interrupt. I think the allegation is, Your Honor, that my client was in possession of the funds. He had obtained 2 letters from the Department of Treasury's general counsel saying, this is how you can transfer, wire transfer the funds into the U.S. Treasury.
Counsel, did you hear my question?
Yes, I did. So let me continue with that. The idea was that he, in possession of the funds, would be responsible for sending those billions back to the United States Treasury per the guidance that was given by the Treasury Department's general counsel. Remember the obligation.
Counsel, what I'm trying to understand is, as I understand it, I could not transfer funds to the U.S. Treasury unless they were funds to which I was legally entitled. And then I would just be making, as it were, a donation to the United States government.
Correct. And what we're saying here, that's exactly what happened. It is possession. It was the funds were in the possession of my client. He was transferring the funds to the U.S. Treasury as a donation. Absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, I don't get any of that from the complaint, but I understand you're saying construe it most favorably to your client. It was totally unclear to me as to, I mean, why would he? I'll cease my questions. Thank you.
No, if you're asking for the motivation, why would he make a donation like that?
Well, no, I'm not asking that.
Okay, I apologize, Your Honor. I don't want to second guess you.
So I have one question for you before you're, and we will give you a little bit of time for rebuttal, which is, let's just suppose conceptually, I'll assume for purposes of this question that conceptually there's a route under which you could say, look, there was no intent to make good on the contract from the very outset. So it was a fraudulent enterprise from the get-go. And that's a way to get around what otherwise could be an impediment to your ability to proceed. But then in order to support that, the complaint can't just allege that there was never an intent. There's got to be something more than that that would allow, even at the dismissal stage, particularly given the particularity requirements associated with fraud claims, that would allow for concluding that there's something to the notion that there was no intent from the outset to make good on the representation. Where in the complaint?
Well, we allege that shortly after this enterprise collapsed, shipwrecked, and my client was imprisoned and came back, the judge had bought very, very fancy home and vehicles, and that when the judge was asked to help when my client was in prison, he said, no, I'm sorry, I can't help you. That is, if you read the complaint carefully, it alleges clear actions by the judge that betray what would ordinarily be expected at his duty if he intended to really serve my client, to try to help him repatriate the money. And he didn't do that. But if you read through the allegations in the complaint, I think you'll find that. But that's the response we have.
Okay. Thank you. Let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions at this time. We'll give you a little bit of time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Cady.
Thank you, Your Honors. Steve Cady for Defendant Appellee Gene Sullivan. May it please the court. Judge Cooper wrote two fulsome and thoughtful opinions in this case, and they should be affirmed. He applied the facts as pled to the law and reached the right conclusion. And as I think the questions this morning indicate, this case must be dismissed, not just because what the complaint does not plead, but exactly because of what it does plead. And with regard to Gene Sullivan, the case must be dismissed and the opinion below affirmed for two independent reasons. First, the district court properly found that plaintiff did not plead a claim for fraud against Sullivan because plaintiff pleaded that Sullivan did in fact provide him with legal services. And there's a crucial paragraph at paragraph 16 of the complaint that Sullivan later entered into a conspiracy with DOJ to capture the funds. And secondly, the district court was correct that plaintiff cannot satisfy the damages element for fraud because the money that he sought to repatriate did not belong to him, of course, and the complaint pleads that the plaintiff told African officials where the money was located and twice brought it to African police stations. Thus, whatever Sullivan did to facilitate a meeting with DOJ in February of 2021 did not cause plaintiff damages, according to what plaintiff pleads in the complaint. These issues require dismissal and cannot be fixed because of what is pled. And I want to flesh those two grounds out in more detail. First, with regard to no fraud, plaintiff says that his flagship allegation of fraud is paragraph 14 of his complaint. And that's where he says that Sullivan said he would be plaintiff's lawyer. As Judge Cooper wrote in the opinion below, the complaint itself is replete, Judge Cooper says, with allegations showing that, in fact, Sullivan did provide legal services to plaintiff. And I'd highlight paragraphs 17 and 18 and 35 and 37 and 39 of the complaint, all of which describe legal services that Gene Sullivan provided to plaintiff, including working with Treasury Department to alert them to funds, working with DOJ to coordinate a meeting to help plaintiff repatriate the funds, and also working with plaintiff's wife to help get plaintiff out of detention when he was in detention. Judge Cooper's analysis of these legal services is found at pages 41 and 42 of the record, where he concludes, quote, Sullivan's agreement to represent plaintiff was literally true. Moreover, though, and this is crucial, the complaint alleges that the attorney-client relationship was formed in June or July of 2020, and that's at paragraphs 12, 13, and 14 of the complaint, June or July of 2020. And it says that Sullivan later, in February of 2021, quote, entered into a conspiracy, close quote, with DOJ lawyers, and that's at paragraph 16 of the complaint. Thus, the complaint does not and cannot be amended to allege that the attorney-client relationship was entered into with the intent to defraud plaintiff, because it alleges that the conspiracy with DOJ was entered into 8 months later in February of 2021, entered into, it says. And it also alleges, of course, that Sullivan provided legal services both before and after that date. And as a result, Judge Cooper properly determined that no fraud was pled. Secondly, there can be no damages for two reasons. First, the complaint makes clear at paragraph 11 that this money is not plaintiff's to begin with. It says it was scattered across Africa after the fall of the Libyan dictator. And Judge Cooper properly determined that that meant that the money did not belong to plaintiff and instead belonged to Treasury, thus the repatriation effort. And that's at page 44 of the appendix. And secondly, there can be no damages because plaintiff himself pleads that he brought the money to two African police stations and he told officials in Africa where it was. And thus, whatever happened at that DOJ meeting in February of 2021, where plaintiff told DOJ the location of the money, can't be tied or can't be the cause of its alleged disappearance, because the cause is pled in the complaint. We know it's because it was delivered to police stations in Africa. And thus, there's no fraud, there are no damages, and Judge Cooper's thoughtful opinion, we submit, should be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the government now. Mr. Janda.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Sean Janda for the United States. I think at this point, everyone agrees that the underlying conduct that the federal officials here are alleged to have engaged in, meeting with the plaintiff, interviewing the plaintiff, is the sort of conduct that they are employed to do. And the only question is whether the sort of bare allegations that that conduct was engaged in for an improper purpose can take it outside of scope. We've explained in our briefs why the bare allegations in this case can't do that work. And I'm happy to address any questions that the court might have, but in the absence of questions, also content to rest on our briefs on this point.
I have just one theoretical question. So there's often fact patterns one sees in the cases where the stream of conduct that the government, the defendant government officer is engaged in, is the kind of thing that we would say at some level of generality, the government officers is employed to do. But then there'll be some kind of detour in the midst of that, that parts ways with what the government officers generally employed to do. And sometimes they're really extreme situations where somebody does something that's, you know, a violent crime or something of that nature that seems obviously outside the scope in some descriptive way of government officers do. And sometimes it's a little bit more of a minor blip, but really we're just talking about kind of frolics and detours in some dimension. And how would you characterize the way in which a court is supposed to know whether the conduct that diverts from the path of what a normal government officer would do takes it outside the zone of something that would be scope for purposes of Westfall Act? How would you describe the inquiry?
Yeah, so I think both Carroll on the substantive law and then this court's opinions on the Westfall Act make clear that you have to look at the underlying conduct, that sort of the controversy that the alleged tort arose out of. And then I think there's just sort of a qualitative analysis about how tightly tied to the job duties the tort ultimately becomes, you know, whether it's a minor blip or a huge detour. That being said, you know, I think in this case, the court certainly doesn't have to address that. The allegations of any sort of blip here, I think, are so threadbare that the court doesn't need to credit them even at the motion to dismiss stage. And sort of disregarding the bare allegations of improper purpose, I think what you're left with is just conduct that is in the core of what these federal employees are.
But when you say, so that might be true on the facts of this case. I mean, I don't want to argue with you on that for now, but when you say a qualitative assessment, what would you do? What are the guideposts? What would you look at? And would you just look at the factors that Carroll outlined? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think Carroll goes through the overall analysis in some detail and specifically focuses on the timing analysis for a couple of pages. I think that hasn't been the focus of our briefing here, but does say that you're looking at the underlying conduct. You're not looking at kind of the tort itself or the moment the tort was committed. You're probably have to be tightly scoped to the tort in some sense. I mean, you're not looking at sort of if you have a multi-day spree that happens that's sort of initially started as a job-related thing, but then goes far off, you're probably outside scope. If there's a kind of momentary blip, you're probably within scope. Where one turns into the other, I think it's pretty hard to provide kind of specific guideposts or analysis. I mean, Carroll is very kind of holistic and qualitative on this point and sort of the rest of the analysis. But here again, I think that the allegations here are just so thin. I think under any plausible pleading standard, the court can disregard them for purposes of resolving the certification question in this case and leave that for another day.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Fine, we'll give you 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate the opportunity. A couple things. My colleague declared that there was a incompatible inconsistency between the allegation that at the time that the attorney-client privilege was established in June of 2020, we allege that there was at that time an intent not to comply with the obligations that were inherent in that relationship and the later conspiracy. But the conspiracy, that doesn't, just because there was, it took time for the defendant, Mr. Sullivan, and he had Army Rangers who were his friends, they were the ones who were involved in this case, to later bring in other people. This doesn't mean that he couldn't have formed his own intent at the outset to plot towards undermining his obligations towards Mr. Plevnik as an attorney. Now, the second thing quickly about the ownership of the funds. Possession is 9/10 of the law. We recited the ordinary standard that if someone possesses funds, unless a rival claimant claims that it's theirs, the law presumes possession is ownership. There was no one in this case that's ever disputed that Istok Plevnik owned the funds that were to be repatriated. Indeed, remember in the complaint, we allege that there were two letters prepared by the General Counsel of the Department of Treasury to Mr. Sullivan saying, this is how you repatriate this money to the U.S. Treasury from Ivory Coast. Two letters that referred to in the complaint. Why would those letters even be drafted if the money was already belonging to the United States? There wouldn't be any need for repatriation. And if Mr. Plevnik didn't have the ownership of the money, he couldn't repatriate it anyway. He'd just be a bystander. And third, with regard to the argument that, well, Mr. Plevnik had disclosed to certain people in Ivory Coast about the whereabouts, and that was the cause of the damage. But we have alleged that if Mr. Plevnik had honored his obligations, the funds would have been repatriated in a timely fashion. The last thing, and I appreciate Your Honor for indulging this, this relates to the point of the Westfall Act. It's clear one of the indispensable prongs for qualification is that at least part of the motivation for the challenged action, at least in part, was actuated by a goal to benefit the employer, here in the United States. Here, what we allege was that the challenged acts were intended to injure the United States by depriving it of $6 billion. Let me give you this quick analogy. Suppose someone says, I'm going to be a toll operator at a booth and get money from the cars that come through the toll. But at the time he becomes that operator, he says, I'm going to steal the money. So he uses his position, taking the tolls, receives the money from the drivers, they go through, and he steals the money. It would be very hard, it seems to me, to say that there was an intent, at least in part, in those circumstances, to benefit the employer. The intent was to benefit himself. If you have no questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take this case under submission.